Meetings Public Safety Subcommittee for Tuesday, March 29, 2005. Open a hearing on House Bill 5044, Department of Justice Phase 2 presentation. We are opening without a quorum. And before we get into...
We have a quorum.
We have a quorum on the House side.
Oh,
we do have a quorum. I stand corrected. Thank you. Thank you very much. Before we get into the continued Department of Justice Phase 2 presentation, I'm going to ask that we look at item number 2, subcommittee announcements, and take care of that business at the beginning.
I did send an email to you or your staff this morning. I think everyone but one has responded, at least for the Department of Corrections tour. I'd like to try to do a state penitentiary tour on Friday morning. And I've heard all back from all but one of you being able to go. And then that will be this Friday, and I'll set the time based on whether there's full, which I don't think there is, and when the House session, which I think meets real early, doesn't it?
8:30.
So we'll set the time. I should know tomorrow on the time, and then we'll, if you want transportation, we'll arrange for it. And I'll make arrangements this afternoon with corrections. On April 15th, and I'll hand out...
Doug, before you go further, Madam Chair, I don't know if my staff responded. I was gone yesterday.
Yours is the one that hasn't. So.
I won't be here Friday, so...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We can easily arrange another time for you with them, too, if that works. I'm also passing around a schedule for the subcommittee. This is the phase two is down there starting this week. I think you've all seen this before. This is a tentative schedule. It could change depending on our progress and other things happening, but you'll also notice that public testimony is scheduled throughout there. For example, tomorrow, part of the day, in this hearing, will be spent on public testimony on the DOJ budget, and that has been posted on the official calendars around the hall. So if you do know someone that plans to testify on various budgets, this is the day at this time that it's slated to be. And then this will give you a schedule for the rest of the period. On April 15th, which is also a Friday, the military department is thinking of putting together a tour. Again, that's a Friday that they would fly you up via helicopter up to, and I know I'm going to get this pronounced wrong, it's Camp Willicombe or whatever. I can never remember how you pronounce that, up in east of 205 in the Portland area. And that will be available for you. And again, we'll get the times to you, but it would be that same sort of Friday morning slot. The only other thing is, if you would like a set of the priority lists with the transmittal memo that went to the co-chairs, I have them behind me.
Let's do a pass on that. Yeah.
Madam Chair.
Senator Devlin?
Can I verify the time for the Oregon State Penitentiary tour?
I need to set the time exactly. It sort of depends. It may be as early as, let's say, 9:30 or so.
Okay. But you know that we have a meeting, or I have a meeting with the co-chairs at 9 o'clock.
Okay. We'll have to check with the co-chair because your staff mustn't have known about that.
Yeah, they weren't certain about the time for the actual tour, and I think they thought it would be later.
Okay.
We should be done by 9:45 or something.
Okay, maybe then we'll
next
set
door.
It for 10 o'clock. And I think DOC at least previously had said they would feed you lunch at the penitentiary at the end of the tour, probably. Actually, she has hers already.
Okay. So, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisner.
So I assume we're not having any full Ways and Means for the next 2 weeks that haven't been scheduled? Or?
I don't think there is one scheduled, at least for this coming Friday.
Okay.
And that we'll also adjust on that.
Thank you.
I think that's it for sort of the subcommittee business or announcements.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Well, let's move into the department's presentation. And we're beginning with the Division of Child Support. And Cindy Chinnock?
That's right.
Division Director, welcome.
Thank you.
And we have Mr. Fields back with us this morning, or this afternoon.
Madam Chair, before she starts again, as of yesterday, this document, unless otherwise noted by the presenter, replaces what's behind the tab for the division, and then there's a secondary tab that says Phase 2. And I know for a couple of divisions, like General Counsel, there's still materials they would like you to keep in there, but if you want to place this in your book, that's where it would go.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gordley and members. I am Cindy Chinock, the Director of the Oregon Child Support Program, Division of Child Support, Department of Justice. Our mission, as you see on the screen in front of you, is about children and the parents who support these children. We have over 250,000 cases in our caseload and collect about $600 million per biennium. The next chart you've seen before just shows you that the Division of Child Support is 41% of the department's budget and 47% of the department's FTE. The next chart shows our revenue by source. It's primarily federal funds and other funds. The pass-through to counties is all federal funds, and general funds is only 10% of the program funding. We have several budget drivers. I'll spend just a minute on each of these. Our caseload continues to increase at a rate of about 1,000 cases per year. We have new and ongoing federal requirements, which we must meet, as was pointed out yesterday, to have a qualified state plan. And without a qualified state plan, there would be penalties against the block grant for temporary assistance to needy families. The economy impacts our ability, and especially as unemployment increases and unemployment benefits run out, affects our ability to establish orders in most cases and also to collect the support for families where the non-custodial parent may have been experiencing either unemployment or underemployment from their prior capacity. And finally, the cost of health insurance. The child support program is responsible for establishing and enforcing medical support for all the children in our caseload, and there will be a new federal performance measure in 2007 regarding the performance in this area, and incentives will be attached to that performance measure as they are to the five other federal performance measures we currently have. As the cost of health insurance increases, the non-custodial parents who are actually providing this insurance and paying that increased cost, their share of that in health coverage, it actually decreases the amount of cash support that's going to the family, so they get credit for that as part of the support for the children. The other effect of this increasing cost of health insurance is that as this goes up, fewer and fewer employers are able to provide this benefit to their employees, and therefore you have families who are unable to provide privately funded health insurance coverage for their children, and they're coming to the state in greater and greater numbers for publicly funded health coverage. The next chart just shows the trend line on the caseload in child support. And then we go to major changes in the program. Some of these we've already heard about a couple of times yesterday. The consolidation of the child support program occurred July 1st of 2003, and this was the final step in fully consolidating the program responsibility for the child support program in the Department of Justice. The National Medical Support Notice was passed by this body last session, and that was a tool that will help us work with employers to find privately funded health coverage for children in as many cases as possible, and that was additional staff and workload for the program. In 1997, welfare reform was probably the most significant program change in child support in recent history, and that had a couple of significant budgetary impacts. The child support program had to build a new automated system to meet all the federal requirements, and we did that and have a certified system. And it changed the distribution of child support, which is important because it put the family first in most all cases except where there is current assistance being received. That reduced then the amount of recoveries that are retained to help support other government services, both child support and child welfare and Oregon Youth Authority, who also receive funds from the work that we do. It furthers the change and sort of puts the final step in the change from this program being welfare recovery to this program being income support to families. And that is represented by our mission and also by the national mission. Our budget was reduced in 2003-05 by 10 FTE, even though the caseload continues to increase. And we have a prioritization scheme in place so that we are working those cases that have the biggest benefit to families. And there are some of the lower priority cases, be them a small number, that may see a delay in services as a result of this. The governor's recommended budget does not recommend any general fund cuts, as you heard yesterday, to the child support program. I'd just like to mention that our goal continues to be to manage the work that we have to do within the appropriated budget and FTE. And to do this, we are continually looking for new methods of doing our work, automated systems, technology, using technology to the fullest extent that we can, to do the job that we have to do to improve our efficiency and our customer service. On the next slide, you see a list of several initiatives that have increased our efficiency and improved our customer service over the last year and a half or so. We implemented an award-winning web-based training system for our child support case managers. It's very complex, and it's an important tool in training our case managers statewide, both in the state offices and the county offices, and reduce the need for travel costs and travel time by having that available at every location. Direct deposit was implemented in December of 2003, and during 2004 we processed $36.5 million out to custodial parents by this method, by direct deposit. Of course, that streamlines the process and also avoids some of the problems and follow-up workload of lost checks or stolen checks or, you know, I put it in my pocket and washed it kinds of questions. And that's growing. That number is growing. We have accounting information online for parents, and I really what this is for a 12-month history of payments by the non-custodial parent and the date of the issue of the payment out to the custodial parent, so that at any point in time they can go into this with their identification numbers and find out if the payment has been made or if a check is on the way, it's in the mail, and they have that available 24/7. We have an average of 75,000 inquiries to this website each month. So it is being used, and that does reduce to some extent the phone calls that come into our case managers asking these very basic questions. The parenting time calculator is a partner piece to the guidelines calculator that you may be aware of, and it is used to help calculate the credit for parenting time for the non-custodial parent, and which is sort of a complex process, but with this calculator it makes that easier. And it's used by parents, by their representatives, and by judges as well in order to accurately reflect the parenting time agreement. You've already heard about automation streamlining, which is the combination of our in-house information systems staff to streamline and look for efficiencies in the support of both the legal divisions and the division of child support. The next three that you see on the list are in process. They have not been implemented yet. We're looking at payment processing streamlining, which is a process that would further automate our payment processing and also image the documents so that that information is available to the case manager on their desktop the day after it's processed. Currently we have have to microfilm all that, and it's a paper retrieval process, and there's delays, and that causes a delay in our customer service as well. So this will help not only streamline the process internally, but provide better customer service. The document generation process that we're looking at will improve our overall document generation process, but one of the main benefits will be that we will be able to produce forms and documents in four languages, English, Spanish, Vietnamese, and Russian. And we translate now all the documents on request, but this will be a more streamlined process and will provide a better customer service to those non-English or limited English-speaking customers. And finally, the stored value card process. This is a statewide initiative, and it, for us, is step two in the process to streamline payments to custodial parents. Many of our parents do not have bank accounts and therefore cannot sign up for direct deposit. This will be a method by which they can receive those payments electronically rather than a check in the mail. It also helps when they're moving around a lot that we don't have to track them so much as far as that address to get those payments there. We still need to try to figure out where they are for other service processes, but for the money to the children and the families, this will help ensure that we can track them around the state or out of the state. And then finally, I just want to mention that even as our caseload has increased and the FTE decreased slightly, and the complexity and service requirements have increased on the program, we continue to improve our cost effectiveness. I reported to you earlier in phase one that our cost effectiveness for federal fiscal year 03 was $5.60. We just got the numbers for 04, and they improved to $6.17. And we continue to be in the top 10 nationally. So I think these initiatives and others, these are sort of the major ones, but there are other smaller ones that we're doing all along, have proven to be effective in terms of our cost effectiveness because we continue to improve. The next slide is our budget history, and you've seen these for the department and at least our first division. I'd really like to go to the next slide to talk about the major changes for the Division of Child Support, because I think this actually gives you a better pictorial of those changes. The bubbles above the chart, the first one is welfare reform. I mentioned that a moment ago, and that added to the program several functions and FTE, and you see that in a not a very large increase, but an increase between 95-97 to 97-98 or 99. The second bubble is the phase one of consolidation, and I haven't really talked about that, but beginning in 98, but most of it was you see in the 99-01 budget year. We moved a large group of the child support accounting function from Department of Human Services to the Department of Justice. That was Hardy's first step in the working toward the full consolidation of the program in the 97 session. It just took a while to phase it in. This included about 130 FTE. So that was a major increase, as you see there. Not much increase between the next two biennium, but then you see full consolidation from 01-03 to 03-05. And again, there were only 9 FTE associated with that, but this brought over all the special payments, the pass-through of the federal funds to the counties, which in this budget will be $16 million. I think it's 14 point something between 01-03 and 03-05. So those are the three major points that have caused increases in our budget over this period of time. The budget drivers, personal services is the largest part of our budget. If you look at the special payments, which are payments to the counties, a large portion of that is also personal services. So you see here that the breakdown of the budget between services and supplies and personal services. We have three budget issues potential impacts to our budget in the future, and 5 policy packages that are included in the governor's recommended budget. So I'm going to go through each of these budget issues. The first one is paternity establishment. You'll see a chart there that shows our performance on the paternity establishment percentage, and a fairly significant drop between 03 and 04. We dipped down below 90% in 04, and that puts us into a corrective action period with this particular performance measure. We must improve our performance by 2 percentage points in order to avoid a penalty, and that's for federal fiscal year 2005. We have been working with the Center for Health Statistics because they maintain this data, and they enter the records from the hospitals for the voluntary acknowledgments. And we're also working with the hospitals to ensure that we meet this requirement. And we are fairly certain that we will meet the 2% increase, but I wanted you to know that that was an issue for us, and we're putting some effort.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much money would we lose if we don't get the 2%?
Chair Gordley and Representative Wisnett, I don't have that with me. It's based on a percentage of the block grant for temporary assistance to needy families. So it's significant, but I am fairly certain that we've got a plan in place that we will raise it by more than 2%.
Representative Wisnett. Thank you, Madam Chair. So is it all or nothing? I mean, so if we're 84%, we lose a little bit. If we're 80%, we lose a lot more. Or is it if we don't meet that threshold, we lose that all?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, we need to improve 2% or the penalty is assessed.
Thank you.
So.
And the reason for the drop?
Chair Gordley, the primary reason for the drop was an issue with the Center for Health Statistics and Records. They had 2 of the critical staffing that enter these records out the last month or so of the biennium of the fiscal year, and so a number of records were not entered. It was not it wasn't a performance issue in the sense that we weren't establishing, but there was a problem with getting the records entered, and if they're not entered, they're not counted.
Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To what extent do you pursue to establish paternity? I mean, how far do you go with that process?
Chair Gordley and Representative Hannah, we, for any case that comes to us for child support services, that's the first step in our process, and we go through extensive process. If paternity is not acknowledged at the time of the birth, which actually accounts for the largest percentage of paternity establishment, so the case comes in and paternity has not been established, we seek to locate the absent parent, the non-custodial parent, the father, and then if that parent will agree to sign the acknowledgement form, that's the preferred method, but we do genetic testing. And if the custodial parent is receiving services from the Department of Human Services, there is a requirement that they cooperate with us in that effort, or they have penalties or sanctions against their welfare amount that's given to the family.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Just with that in mind, one of the things I think as legislators, we've probably all gotten a letter from somebody about child support issues of I am or am not the parent. What happens if a father just says, I'm not the father? Do you check both ways? I mean, you're seeking to get paternity, but what if somebody says, nah, it's not me? Do you do the test? Do you charge that person? How does that work?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hannah, we do have a process by which paternity can be challenged. Actually, there are a number of ways. For instance, at the time of the birth of the child, sometimes the euphoria of this new baby, an individual will sign that acknowledgement when they know, in fact, they're not the father. And there is a year period of time which they can come back without any process at all and just say, no, I rescind that. I am not the father. And then if the mother chooses to push that, they can then ask for additional testing. The same is true in the case of an alleged father. If there's a process, we have fathers that come in and say, I am that father, and the mom for some reason doesn't want that associated. We work both ways, so they get the service either way. There are limits about time frame within which that issue can be raised, and there, I believe, is a bill, at least, I don't know if it's been heard yet, this session that would open the opportunity for challenging that, the paternity, well, at any point in time.
Hmm. Thank you.
Please continue. Okay. Oregon Youth Authority, your staff, Mr. Wilson, mentioned yesterday that there is or has been a federal audit of the child support program. It was a limited cost audit. There were a number of issues which resulted in actually affirming what we were doing. And the one area in which they continued to have questions was Oregon Youth Authority. We do not have even the draft audit results at this point, but we have verbal indication that their intent is to disqualify the close custody cases, which are those where the youth is in a facility like McLaren or Hillcrest. And in those cases, they find that to be general obligation of the state, not a child support issue. And therefore, in any of the cases that they then disqualify, we would not receive the federal funding, which is the 66% match. And we would also lose our ability to use some of the enforcement remedies that are available only to qualified 4D cases. Now, where we are, we don't have, as I said, we do not have the draft report yet. When we receive that draft, we will respond to it. We'll get the final audit. We'll evaluate the final audit for any opportunity to appeal. All of that's going to take time. We don't know yet when it's going to finally resolve. I imagine it could be as late as the end of this year, this calendar year. In the meantime, we do know that there is potential repayment of the federal funds for federal fiscal year 02, 03, and 04. And we've estimated that to be in a range of $0.7 to $1.4 million. And our ending balance, beginning balance, we believe that we have enough to cover that potential repayment. The ongoing issue, and we just can't really address what that's going to be into the future, would be funding for services on those cases in the future, because we will lose the federal funds for those, for working those cases, but Oregon law requires us to work all Oregon Youth Authority cases that are referred to us. So that is a potential funding issue for the future, and we certainly would come back and talk with you. We're working very closely with Oregon Youth Authority on this issue, and as we get the audit, draft audit results and the final audit, we will continue to work with them.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just so we understand, or I understand, so we're talking about cases in the Oregon Youth Authority that are serious cases, that close custody. Is that what we're saying? Is that they're saying that they may not honor those and we'd have to repay that amount? And
yes.
How many, I guess it matters. You said, I wrote down 0.7 million to 1.4 million was what the repayment could be. Is that correct? Thank you.
The period of time covered by the federal audit, is it the 02, 03, 04?
Chagorley, that's
years?
Correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I can understand this. We will lose the federal funding that helps our collection effort, but still actually collecting dollars from the parents for kids that are in closed custody, that's still required by Oregon law.
Chair Gorley, Representative Hansen, yes, that is still required by Oregon law. So we have an issue of the funding of those services in order to maintain the revenue to Oregon Youth Authority, and there are there are probably options about that we haven't even gotten to a point of a recommendation of what that would be yet, but that certainly we'd work together with the Urban Youth Authority to bring that forward.
Mr. Wilson.
Just a clarification point. Part of the issue here is makes it a little more difficult. Kids move in and out of closed custody, so they're eligible when they're not in closed custody, but not eligible. And you may want to just mention or make sure OYA mentions, does this have an impact on OYA's budget as well as yours?
Right, and I would, the third point, which is not on your slide, is that at a minimum, it's going to have a loss of revenue to the Oregon Youth Authority for any of those cases that are disqualified because they will not be able to be submitted for federal tax offset. And some portion of the revenue to Oregon Youth Authority is as a result of our submitting those for offset of federal tax refunds. So I don't have that number with me, though.
Are the co-chairs aware of this issue?
I don't think they are, at least from DOJ's side. I'd have to check if Sheila's talked to him about the OYA.
Okay, let's flag this one.
Please continue. The next issue is a fiscal on House Bill 2213. Just for your information, it's the only bill that has a fiscal at this point in time. It removes the requirement for the child support program to provide limited services to spousal-only cases. These would be cases where there's never been child support, only spousal support. And there is no federal requirement that we work these cases. It would save $45,000 general fund, a total of $133,000 all funds. However, if one FTE was removed from the budget, because this is not a full workload, full caseload, there would be also a loss of revenue to the state that supports the program of $51,000.
I'm missing something here. Why do we need to do this? Someone thinks this is a good idea. Why?
Just to Chair Gordley, are you asking why would we ask to remove this requirement? We are asking to remove this requirement because this is a very small part of the workload, but as we're prioritizing our workload to our mission, this doesn't relate to the mission, and it does free up some resource to focus on child support.
All right. That's helpful. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to know how much money you collect on this program in terms of how cost-effective it is, obviously.
Chair Gordley and Representative Hanson, I'll get that number for you.
Thank you.
Very good. Good question.
Okay. We have five policy packages that are included in the governor's recommended budget. They're pretty straightforward. I'll quickly go through these. 104 is our partner piece to the one you heard from Admin Services yesterday, moving one position from child support to Admin Services, no dollar impact. 106 is simply the amount of money that would be amount of charge that would be charged to Division of Child Support based on policy packages in the administrative offices. So if those policy packages are approved, then this is our share of those costs, and there is a general fund impact of $118,000. 161 is parental access and visitation grant dollars. These grants are annual non-competitive grants to states to provide services to families who are having issues with access and visitation through grantees. And this is seeking approval to apply for and those grants and expend those federal funds in the amount of $125,000. 163 is a pilot project to work with Multnomah County Circuit Court to identify those court costs that are eligible for federal match in child support, and this would be a pass-through of the federal match to the court of $300,000. We're requesting non-limited federal funds for that. And finally, 165 is a request to change our federal fund pass-through to counties from limited to non-limited.
Sure. Representative Wisner.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Could you go back and explain policy package 106 again?
106 is based on, let me just say, admin services or the administrative branch, including the Office of the Attorney General. Those charges are allocated based on our use of the services to all the divisions. And there are some policy packages that would add services within administrative services, and those then that cost is distributed to the various divisions, and this is our portion of those costs. If all of the current policy packages that are in the governor's recommended budget are approved. Now, that doesn't include those in the legal divisions because those are not charged to the child support program. So this would be those that were listed yesterday by the administrative services.
So, Madam Chair, follow up.
Certainly.
Thank you. So you're saying we're going to charge you, the Attorney General, some his time for each case you work? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, it's an allocation formula. It's not per case. It's by, in some case, administrative services, for instance, has in human service, in our human resources department, has a staff completely dedicated to child support. That's charged to us. Some others, a portion of their time is charged to us. They track their time and would charge it to the appropriate program. In the case of the general overhead of the Attorney General's office, that's just allocated based on staffing in the divisions or some formula. Administrative services could tell you for sure what that formula is.
Madam Chair, I have some questions on this package. I think it will be raised during work session. I'll try to get to the questions then, if that helps at all.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation.
Okay, we are moving to the General Counsel Division.
Madam Chair, as they come forward, there is more information in the pack that they did not cover for a little more detail on what she went into for your reading pleasure, I guess.
Mr. Arnold.
Good afternoon, Chair Gordley, members of the subcommittee. For the record, my name is Don Arnold. I am Chief Counsel of the General Counsel Division. Before I get into my presentation, I do want to mention to you there are several items that were provided to you during our Phase 1 hearing. Actually, they came to you labeled as Phase 2 materials, but when you're sorting through and tossing out things from your packet, you probably want to save these two items. One is a detailed report on the client services survey. I understand there were a few questions about that yesterday, and I think that the information in this, the report on the survey that you'll find in your packet probably will address almost any question you might have about that. The second item I would ask you to save is information related to a budget note that the Department of Justice responded to. First, I believe, at the August e-board last year, but we were also directed in that budget note to provide updated information during our Ways and Means presentation. So the August report and the updated information is included. This budget note dealt with Department of Justice granting of exemptions for legal sufficiency contract review.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hanna.
I'm not sure, Mr. Arnold, that I have which exact pages we're saving and which we're throwing away, and we might need, because we're going to get one of these for every one of these groups, a little written list that would help us. Otherwise, we're never going to have the same book.
Chair Gordley, maybe it'd be simplest if I just provided you with additional copies of those two inserts to your material.
That would be very helpful.
Well, I want to continue the discussion that we began concerning the general counsel budget during phase one hearings. And first, I want to give you just a quick review of what the division does, how we're organized, some of the functions we carry out, a little bit about our budget history, and then talk about the policy package that we're presenting to you. As you may recall from our previous discussions in phase one, the mission of the General Counsel Division is to provide timely and cost-effective legal service to all of the state's agencies. We provide the day-to-day legal service that's required by every state agency. Almost everything that we do is in direct response to requests from agencies for that service. Most of the work we provide is in the form of either oral or written legal advice, but we also provide a fair amount of specialized litigation services to the state. For example, we represent the Department of Revenue in tax court. We represent Department of Human Services in child dependency hearings in juvenile court. We appear on behalf of the state in Land Use Board of Appeals or and in Employment Relations Board hearings. We put a great deal of emphasis on preventative advice and on training for state agencies. We think that in the long term, those are dollars well spent in terms of restraining the increase in overall state legal costs. And we have an active dispute resolution program in the division. Chair Gordley, I should probably also add there is a lot more information included in these PowerPoint slides that I'm probably going to be able to cover during the oral presentation, so I'm going to skim through some of them fairly quickly, but if you would like follow-up information on any of this, let me know. This chart shows two aspects of the General Counsel Division in relation to the overall department budget. First is expenditures. General Counsel represents about 14% of the entire overall department expenditures. And then the chart on the right indicates the proportion of General Counsel FTE to total department FTE. And these figures are all from the governor's recommended budget. Because the division provides advice in such a wide range of legal subject areas, we found it most efficient to organize this advice by grouping state agencies that have related legal issues together and then designating a group of attorneys to provide advice to those agencies. So we've organized the division into nine different practice areas, and each of these practice areas, with a couple exceptions, are assigned a group of related state agencies that they work with. So, for example, the Natural Resources section would be tasked with providing legal services to all of the state's agencies that have a role with natural resources. The next chart reflects the breakdown within the division budget of various aspects of that budget, and you'll see personal service really is driving the division budget. That's about 85% of our expense. We have no capital outlay and no special payments. 15% of the budget is services and supplies. The next chart, The next chart illustrates two different aspects of the division budget over a 10-year period looking back and also looking forward into the governor's recommended budget. The line graph at the top of the chart reflects changes in FTE over this time period. And I call your attention to the last 6 years, the six-year period ending this biennium. Essentially, FTE has been flat during that period. That reflects a fall off in workload, or at least a slowdown in the growth of workload during that period, so we have been able to handle workload with current FTE. You'll see an increase reflected here in the governor's recommended budget for next biennium. That is entirely associated with the one policy package that we'll discuss a little later. The next chart really is just a more detailed reflection of what you saw in the preceding slide. This is, again, total expenses and FTE reflected over a 10-year period.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnot.
Thank you. Sir, back on the budget history, is there any reason you can give us for why the services and supply increased significantly from 1999 to 2? Is that more?
Well, as I said, Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnot, most of the division's budget is associated with personnel cost at 85%. So when you're looking at the increase in overall expenses for the division, that is largely a reflection of increases in personnel cost. COLAs, step increases, increases in cost of insurance.
Clarification, Madam Chair. No, I'm talking about the services and supply line. It seems you went from 44, which was on, you know, going up a little bit, to way down, and we're up to 55 and 57.
Madam Chair, one reason, Representative Wisnot, for that is I think between the 0103 budget and the 0305 budget, some of the sort of state government charges and some of those things which had been centrally paid were sent out to the division, so the divisions paid them. So that may be the increase from the 3.6 to the 5.5 or explain part of that increase. But we can we'll get some more information on that for you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. The next two slides reflect some of the budget drivers for the division in terms of areas where we are seeing significant amounts of workload that are requiring significant dedication of legal resources in the division.
Are these in a rank order?
Chair Gordley, they are not ranked in order. The reason I selected these, and there, you know, there could have been a number of others on these pages, these are all legal issues that were significant workload contributors this biennium, and all of them will be significant contributors next biennium. You undoubtedly are familiar with a number of them from your work here in the Legislative Assembly. Others have been in the newspaper. I'd be happy to provide you with additional information about any of them if you'd like that. The next chart reflects some areas of either current significant increases in workload or areas where we anticipate there may be some change in workload in the next biennium. Measure 37, we are already seeing the workload increase here. Since this measure was enacted in November of 2004, the General Counsel Division has been devoting a little over 3 FTE of attorney time to working on Measure 37 issues. We have hired one limited duration attorney to help address this workload. It's likely that before the end of this biennium, we probably will need to hire a second limited duration attorney. We are just beginning to see requests from agencies that are related to specific Measure 37 claims that have been filed with the state. At this point, I think there are in excess of 200 of those claims, and they're continuing to come in at the rate of about 3 a day. So, as you can see, that is at least a potential source of significant additional workload. The Division of State Lands Issues reflects a policy package in that agency's budget that would fund one additional attorney in the General Counsel Division. That attorney would work with the Division of State Lands on the Portland Harbor Environmental Cleanup Project. And finally, the Department of Justice Oregon University System issues. There are two things at play here that could affect our workload. One is a Senate bill, Senate Bill 220. This bill has not yet had a hearing, but it would authorize the Oregon University System to employ its own attorneys rather than going to the Department of Justice for legal service. The second thing that could affect workload in this area is the Attorney General has been in negotiations with the Oregon University System over the possibility of that system employing some in-house attorneys who the Attorney General would then designate as Special Assistant Attorneys General. So if either of those possibilities moves forward, that would likely have a negative impact on workload for General Counsel in the sense of reducing requests for services from the university system. Now, I've listed all three of these topics here simply to illustrate the point that over the course of any biennium, we can count on one thing, and that is seeing increases and decreases. We can't always predict where it's going to come from or how big any particular increase or decrease may be, but we know that we're going to see some agencies increase their level of requests for service, and we're going to see other agencies decrease what they want from us.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Arnold, the Portland Harbor, is that part of the state lands?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisnett, the state does own land in the Portland Harbor area, so some of this cleanup involves state lands. Other portions of the cleanup simply involve privately owned property that has environmental problems that is subject to cleanup orders. But Division of State Lands, a DEQ, and several other state agencies are working with both local government and private property owners in that area to affect a general cleanup of the harbor area.
Thank you.
Going back to the Oregon University System, legal services, and the proposed Senate bill, what are the pros and cons there around that bill?
Chair Gordley, I see mostly cons. I think that the Department of Justice offers a great deal to the state in terms of having consistent legal advice by providing advice to all of state government. I think when you station attorneys in an agency who are accountable to the agency director, who are paid by that agency, I think that independence of advice suffers from to some extent. I think that having centralized legal service offers economies in providing legal service because, you know, frankly, the Department of Justice has 200 or so attorneys. We have specialties in a wide variety of legal subject areas. There is no way that any single agency can replicate that with their in-house staff. And that means either they're going to be depending on staff who have less training in particular areas that they may need, or they're going to have to go to outside counsel. And, you know, outside counsel costs 2, 3, 4 times what it costs to get the same service through the Department of Justice. So I think there are a lot of negatives, and frankly, I don't see many positives.
Are you aware of a fiscal impact on that bill?
Chair Gordley, I am not.
Senate Bill 220. I'll look into it. Let's continue.
The next chart lists some of the steps that the division has implemented to try and achieve some efficiencies in how legal services are provided to the state. We provide a great deal, or place a great deal of emphasis on training for state agencies. In the course of a typical year, we may present anywhere from 100 to 150 different training sessions or programs of one type or another. We have another number of publications that we develop for use by state government. Some of these are very comprehensive manuals. The Public Meetings and Records Manual, for example, or the Administrative Procedures Manual, or the Public Contracting Manual. These are comprehensive treatments of those areas of the law. They are very widely used throughout state government, and in fact, several of them are widely used by local government as well. We have an active appropriate dispute resolution program that provides services both within the Department of Justice and has an outreach program to state agencies. I'm going to skip the rest of the items on that chart and move to our policy package. This is the only policy package being presented by General Counsel Division. It is funded by a corresponding package in the Department of Human Services budget. And I briefly mentioned this during our Phase 1 hearings. Can you move to the graph? Yeah. Let me just give you a quick overview of what's involved here. The Department of Human Services has legal custody of a very large number of Oregon children, I think somewhere in the neighborhood of 14,500 to 15,000. And these children have been committed to Department of Human Services custody because a court has concluded that they have been subject to child abuse or neglect. There is a fairly elaborate hearing process in juvenile court by which the court makes these determinations, and that is reflected in the jurisdictional stage hearings on this chart. Once the court makes the decision that in fact the allegations of child abuse or neglect have been proven, it then determines whether custody of that child should be given to Department of Human Services. If it decides that Department of Human Services should receive legal custody, it then decides what kind of services DHS should be required to provide both to the child and to the parents of the child to try and reunite that family. So this moves into the permanency planning stage of the hearing process. And here, there are a number of hearings that are required by both state and federal law, and the intent of the law there is to require DHS to move these children as quickly through this process as they can and to make a permanent planning decision for that child so the child isn't left in limbo. So the court wants DHS to make every reasonable effort to move that child back into the family, or if that's not possible, to find other permanent placement for the child. But this whole process is fairly complex. It involves a number of different hearings, different kinds of hearings. I've listed some of them on the bottom of this this slide. During 2004, Department of Human Services was a party in over 21,000 of these trials and hearings. They had legal representation in about 5% of those cases. DHS caseworkers are not attorneys. These are court proceedings, and what that means is the DHS caseworker cannot call witnesses, can't cross-examine or examine witnesses, can't make legal argument to the court, can't make motions to the court. So this obviously places DHS at a pretty severe handicap in being able to advocate effectively for the best interest of the child in these cases. This problem is made even worse by the fact that there are often a number of other parties to these cases, including the child, the child's parents, often represented by separate attorneys, and other interveners like grandparents or other relatives. And typically, all of these other parties have legal counsel representing them. Often, their legal counsel have been appointed by the court, so the state is paying for those counsel. So there's a little irony here that DHS ends up being the only party in the proceeding who doesn't have an attorney representing them. So what this package would seek to do is provide additional attorney services to appear on behalf of DHS in these cases. This package really is only a small step toward addressing the problem because it would move the rate at which they receive representation from about 5% of the total cases to about 15%. Nevertheless, that is a significant step in the right direction and certainly would be of great assistance to DHS. The other side of this problem is that because there are so few legal resources available to DHS in these child dependency cases, almost all of the attorney time that is available is dedicated to court appearances. So that means the caseworkers in their day-to-day work have very little access to legal counsel or legal advice. So the package also would seek to increase the amount of attorney time that's available to provide advice and consultation services to the caseworkers. The package provides for 19 staff, 12 attorneys, 3 paralegals, and 4 legal secretaries. It is supported by the Department of Human Services. As I mentioned, they have a corresponding package in their budget that would actually fund this package. And it is also endorsed by the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Chair Gordley, members of the committee, that concludes my remarks. But if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them.
Senator Devlin.
Can I just get a clarification, please? In indicating that this is also included as a Department of Human Services recommendation, are there sources of funding in both agencies, or is the Department of Human Services transferring funds to the Department of Justice for this function?
Madam Chair, maybe I can answer that. DHS has the general fund and federal funds in their budget, in the governor's proposed budget for this. Then the money is sent over here and spent as other funds. So, and that's the general way that all of the general counsel works. The original funding sits out the agencies, the services provided. DOJ bills those agencies and are paid by the agencies for those services, and this would be no different.
I have a follow-up, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I have a general feeling that federal dollars are not as plentiful in child protection areas as they are in health care. What would be the split on this in terms of...
If you asked me 2 years ago, I probably could have answered the question in a matter of seconds.
Yes.
But you don't get the 60-40 match you do in these kinds of child welfare, but there are still federal funds, and we can get that information for you.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The plans to locate them in Portland, Salem, Eugene, Medford, Pendleton, is that based upon population? Are you thinking about consolidation, or did you look at numbers, or how did those locations?
Chair Gordley, Representative Wisner, they are based on population. They're actually based on caseload, DHS caseload. We've tried to place the attorneys in areas of greatest caseload, and our goal is to have attorneys located whenever possible within 30 miles of the courthouse where they'll need to appear.
Follow up.
Senator Devlin.
In this case, where you have a limited number of attorneys in a limited number of communities, quite a number of caseworkers handling quite a number of cases,
Is this going to put the attorneys primarily simply in an advisor to the caseworker, or actually normally appearing in court on behalf of DHS?
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, I think the attorneys will do both. We currently appear in court, as I said, in about 5% of the cases and actually handle the case. So this would increase the number of those cases where we actually make the court appearance. But we also provide advice, just general legal advice, on whatever legal issues might arise during the caseworker's work.
Certainly.
Would this be a selective expansion to 15%? I mean, would you be selecting higher priority cases where there might be more complex legal issues, or could we see a proposal next session to go to 30% and then 45% the following?
Chair Gordley, Senator Devlin, actually we presented the 40% proposal several sessions ago, but it didn't go anywhere. We do prioritize the cases. Right now, in deciding which of the 5% we go to, we can only go to the ones that are most complex and most in need of having an attorney, or in some cases, we go because the judge simply says, I'm not going to let the caseworker practice law in my court. Get an attorney in here. That has happened as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
I would like to get a deeper understanding of the moving from 5% to 15%. The package adds 19 positions. And so that's 19 on top of what number of positions currently serving the 5%.
Chair Gordley, I believe there are 7 or 8 attorneys who are devoted to this casework. So if you work out the numbers as a flat percentage, you would come up with something a little less than 15%, probably 13 or 14%. But as I mentioned in response to Senator Devlin's question, we are dealing now with the most complex of these cases. So as we move up into a higher percentage of cases being covered, you know, some of them are going to be less complex and will take less attorney time, so we're assuming that we're going to be able to handle a few more than if they were all at that higher complexity level.
But we will still have the problem of inadequate access to legal representation on the part of DHS caseworkers representing children.
Chair Gordley, I think that's correct.
And if we were to look at serving 100% of the need, what would that look like in terms of the total number of positions?
Chair Gordley, I can get those figures for you. I don't have them at the tip of my tongue, but it seems like it was something like 40 or 50 attorneys altogether.
So that has been figured
out. I think
out.
We have run those numbers, yes.
Okay. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably a more relevant question for the Human Services Committee when we're working on the DHS portion of this. But are you aware of any savings for DHS if there are 19 additional state employees working on courtroom representation and stuff? Will that free up caseworkers that are currently involved in court situations? Will that allow them more time to be doing maybe more appropriate duties, or are we going to end up with them attending court too to be there as a resource for the attorneys?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hansen, you've asked a question that has a fairly complicated answer. I think that this certainly will free up some caseworker time, because right now caseworkers are running around acting as legal investigators or as paralegals, trying to round up witnesses, getting people to show up in court. So they are staffing these cases rather than staffing their case. So to the extent that this package will provide resources to take over a lot of that kind of work that caseworkers are doing, yes, it will free up their time. I think, and this question really probably is more better directed to Department of Human Services, but in their policy package, they also include, in addition to funding for the Department of Justice package, they include some fairly significant shifts in their personnel. Their package includes, for example, a number of paralegals who would be on their staff, who would work closely with the Department of Justice attorneys, doing a lot of what the caseworkers are doing now. But the difference is these would be people who would have training to do that case preparation, getting witnesses ready to go to court, gathering evidence to be used in the trial. So the caseworkers wouldn't be doing that kind of work any longer. Now, I think their package also contemplates that they would reduce somewhat the number of caseworkers and replace some of those caseworkers with these paralegals. So there's a lot of shifting of resources taking place here between the two policy packages.
Thank you very much, Mr. Arnold. Criminal Justice Division, Mr. Briggs, Steve Briggs. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Members of the subcommittee, my name is Stephen Briggs. I'm the Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. And up before you is a copy of our mission statement. I've already covered a lot of this material in our phase one, so I'm going to go through some of this fairly quickly. Obviously, our mission is to provide support to state law enforcement in the form of investigations, prosecutions, and intelligence and analysis. Our core programs consist of three different sections: the District Attorney Assistance section, which encompasses our work on investigation and prosecution to aid these district attorneys, assisting the Secretary of State in investigation and prosecution of election law criminal violations, as well as conducting training and providing training materials for both district attorneys, deputy district attorneys, and various law enforcement agencies. Second section is our organized crime section, which encompasses a number of programs, including our criminal intelligence unit. We conduct investigations and prosecutions of large-scale, complex, organized crime matters. We do public corruption investigations when requested by various law enforcement agencies or district attorneys. Our part of the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force, which includes the Department of Revenue and the State Police, our part of that also falls under the organized crime section. We have a recently created Internet Crimes Against Children program, and then we also provide assistance to the DPSST, Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, in that we do decertification hearings on behalf of them when they decertify a police officer, fireman, or a security guard. And then our third section is the Crime Victims Assistance section, and I am not going to address that here today. Connie Gallagher, our head of that section, will follow me, and she'll be able to address that more specifically. This slide here reflects the expenditures and FTEs in relation to the rest of the department. You will see that a large chunk of the funding goes through the criminal crime victims section, and that $17 million through the district attorney assistance and organized crime sections. However, the district attorney and organized crime sections account for 61 positions, and the crime victim section accounts for approximately 25 positions. The budget history slide here shows the progress over the past 10 years. I think of significance, it's important to note that the increase in positions that we've had reflects some of the programs that have developed over the last 10 years, including the high-intensity drug trafficking area program, which is a federal initiative, or known as HIDA, that provides money to attack high-intensity drug programs. And we have used funding from that to create 13 federally funded positions in our intelligence unit, which really has had a dramatic impact on the success of that unit. So this budget history reflects, in part at least, the increase of 13 positions federally funded through HIDA. It also reflects 8 additional positions that were created for the Department of Justice in the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force, and then 2 other positions that were created through our Internet Crimes Against Children program, which also is federally funded. Here, this slide reflects payments that are made associated with the criminal justice, and you'll see that 60% are special payments. These are primarily pass-through payments through the crime victims section. Our budget drivers, what's driving our workload, a number of things. Obviously, requests for assistance from district attorneys. Also, when a district attorney resigns, by law, the governor then appoints a replacement, and frequently the governor will ask the attorney general to assume the role as the district attorney until a suitable replacement can be found. Throughout history, that has sometimes lasted for up to a year or more, where we've had one of our staff members serving as the district attorney, and that has a significant impact on our workload. Similarly, aggravated murder cases take an inordinate amount of time and resources, as well as when we have significant turnover in district attorneys. When you have a lot of new DAs who may not be comfortable with certain laws or may not have experience with certain types of prosecutions, they're more likely to call on us for assistance. Another driver for our workload is the success that we've had in the last couple of years with our intelligence operation. As I mentioned, we've had an increase in funding to the federal government to create new positions, and we've had a tripling of our intelligence cases in the last 3 years, which means that we're providing a good product to law enforcement agencies, and when they come to us for intelligence or analytical assistance, they discover that we also have investigative and prosecutorial services to provide as well. We're a small agency in the law enforcement world. We have 11 line investigators and 8 line prosecutors. And so there's a lot of people in the law enforcement community in the state who don't know about what we do, and they are being introduced to the services we provide through the success that we're having in our intelligence unit. Another driver that we're finding is that of workload is the sophistication of criminals nowadays. More and more criminals are learning to use the computer and learning to use the Internet, and that it's much easier to investigate a theft from Sears than it is to investigate a theft over the Internet, and that complexity results in more workload. Obviously, another driver for us is some of the complications with methamphetamine and narcotic investigations. An example would be with the relatively recent changes in our marijuana laws for medical marijuana. One of the unanticipated consequences of that is that it's much more difficult to do an investigation involving an indoor marijuana grow operation. It takes much more resources to do that. Similarly, with methamphetamine, we're finding that there's a lot more complications associated with methamphetamine investigations nowadays. You may have heard recently there was a fairly large distributor of precursor chemicals that was taken down. And associated with that, we, through our intelligence analysis, we were able to identify a large number of potential cooks or people who are buying those chemicals to take them to manufacturers of methamphetamine. Due to resources, although we were aware of them through some good analysis work, due to resources, a number of those people just were not followed up with because various law enforcement agencies, state, federal, and local, just couldn't do anything with that. Lastly, I'd like to briefly mention that election law violations have increased quite a bit in the last 4 years. And our services to the Department of Safety Standards and Training the number of cases have not increased, but it's been our experience that more and more people who are being decertified are obtaining counsel, which means that we have, instead of default judgments, we have long, drawn-out hearings, and that's another workload driver for us. A couple of the program changes in the last couple of years. We created a terrorism intelligence network. I briefly touched on that the last time through. That is through funding we obtained from Homeland Security grants. The purpose of that is to help us track and gather intelligence and conduct investigations related to domestic terrorism, be it environmental terrorism, be it militant groups on the right, hate groups, or whether it be international terrorism.
Can you jump to down to the Oregon State Intelligence Network and tell us the relationship between the two, the Terrorism and Intelligence Network and the Oregon State piece?
Madam Chair, I can. The Oregon State Intelligence Network is now an online network that connects law enforcement throughout the state and all the police departments, where they have the ability to enter criminal intelligence onto our database, and that is then accessible by other law enforcement members who may be working similar cases. It's been a tremendous success for us in the last 2 years. It went online about 2 years ago. Now, members of the Terrorism Intelligence Network also use that backbone of an intelligence network in order to gather and maintain criminal intelligence related to terrorism issues. And in fact, we have a secure email capability that's encrypted email that allows us to communicate among law enforcement on terrorism-related issues. And so that's a real benefit to our terrorism effort, having the Oregon State Intelligence Network.
Which agency is the convener, if you will, of the intelligence network?
That is the Department of Justice.
It is the Department of Justice.
Yes.
And so then what is the role of Homeland Security as it relates to intelligence?
To the State Office of Homeland Security?
The State Office of Homeland Security. What is the relationship of that office? Well, let me back up. I'll tell you what I would like to see that I have not yet seen. A map, if you will, that lays out the relationships of these different agencies or partners in that are a part of the State Intelligence Network or Homeland Security / Terrorism Network. What does that all look like if we map it out and we do it showing the hierarchical relationships between agencies? I don't think I've seen that displayed anywhere.
Madam Chair, I can tell you, I can give you a complicated version, and I'll try to, and I can also give you a simple version, because I have seen that type of
simple version. Let's start there. Let's start with the simple version.
Very good. The Homeland Security is not a law enforcement agency, and so my understanding is primarily their mission is to help develop systems to respond to emergencies, be they terrorism-related, they could be natural disasters, volcanoes, anything like that. Our function is much smaller in that we are law enforcement intelligence, and we're purposely trying to keep our operation relatively small. So we coordinate and talk with people from the Office of Homeland Security, and yet because we're law enforcement and we're gathering information that is sensitive that we cannot necessarily share with civilians, our information is not made available to the Office of Homeland Security. So we'll have the Office of Homeland Security doing all the civilian responsibilities, really a large undertaking, and then we have a small number of officers devoted to gathering intelligence among the state law enforcement community. So we have 25 members of this network who cover the whole state, and each of these members is responsible for gathering information related to potential terrorism issues that are criminal within their region. I hope that helped to clarify a little.
It opens the door. I would like to see a map of the universe, if you will, a map of the intelligence universe that has the Homeland Security piece and all the other
state police,
all the agencies are out there doing something around this area. That also shows where the staffing is assigned, and that also that also displays what the funding amounts are, where the funding amounts are coming from. We know most of it is federal, or all of it is federal.
Madam Chair, we should add the military departments too.
Military.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I will do the best that I can. I don't have access necessarily to all the information within the Office of Homeland Security. I can tell you with regard to the state police that we share an office with their Office of Public Safety and Security. They have, I think, now three persons assigned, and we have two persons, an analyst and an investigator, assigned permanently full-time to terrorism intelligence efforts.
But I'm also trying to get a better handle on what this coordination look like. And how is coordination defined by these different agencies who all have some role in protecting Oregonians in this new world that we live in? Representative Wisnot, do you want to help me out here?
No,
can you think of anything else?
Well, Madam Chair, I think you've asked some very good questions. The bill that we're looking at for the Homeland Defense does say they have a prevention mission. It's not just the old Office of Emergency Management. Now, that bill has not been approved, and they have not been organized, but also in that bill it talks about an intel collection, too. So I think that's what Madam Chair is asking. We want to be sure that we're not creating duplication here or that we're getting the information we need to the public in a timely manner. Too.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, all I wanted to do was to state the obvious, that if Mr. Briggs' explanation of what they do is in fact what they do, and I understand they might be advocating for this additional intelligence component, actually staying the Office of Emergency Management would make it much more understandable to the public what they actually do than just trying to use a catchy name of Office of Homeland Security.
Senator Devlin, we're going to be having that conversation. Yes, we will be. Please continue.
Thank you. Madam Chair, to continue briefly to talk about our Internet Crimes Against Children program, again, this is two positions that are federally funded that focus on gathering information, complaints, concerning primarily child porn investigations and child abuse through the Internet. It's only been in operation for 5 months and tremendously successful. I'm very pleased with that operation. And then our police event safety system, that's not its name. It has another name, which is known to law enforcement. But what that means is anytime a law enforcement plans an event such as a search warrant or surveillance, there's a significant risk of conflicting with another operation. We have provided a service where that agency can call us, we map it out, and we can tell them if another agency is going to be doing something in the same environment. It's caught on very quickly and is being used by law enforcement throughout the state.
Okay, now you said that's not its name. It has another name. So
the other name is called law deconfliction. It's a name that's a buzzword in law enforcement, and I did not want to cause more confusion with its use, but I've used it anyway.
Well, I think we all have dictionaries. We'll look that up.
Deconfliction?
Yes.
Okay.
Moving on, the governor's recommended budget, obviously 10% reduction in the organized crime and district attorney's assistance section. Some of the issues that we'll face with that level of reduction, I believe we'd be forced to decline cases probably from district attorneys or law enforcement agencies at the prosecution level, the investigation level, and at the analytical level. And what that means, I think, is that we are not like a district attorney's office where they might be able to say we're not going to prosecute certain small misdemeanors. Most of the cases that we get have some significance. If not on a statewide level, certainly at a local level. And it's very difficult for us to decline to take a case that has important significance within a particular county. Also, it's worth mentioning that the majority of the counties in Oregon have very small district attorney's offices, and there are situations when they simply can't take on a big case because they don't have the workload or the staff to deal with that, and that's where we can be of value to them. And another downside of us declining to take cases is that, as a practical matter, people won't ask us again, and I think the community will suffer if if we do not maintain those good cooperative relationships with law enforcement agencies and with district attorneys.
Assistance to rural communities, you have that highlighted. Can you say more about what that impact would look like? What will you not be able to do?
Madam Chair, I think that what that might result in is if we were to decline to take a case, I can only give examples of certain types of cases. For example, right now we're working a very complex organized crime case in northeastern Oregon involving potential public corruption and malfeasance of office. And those types of complex racketeering organized crime investigations take a lot of time and a lot of effort, and that may very well be the type of case we'd have to decline to take. And a district attorney's office may be able to prosecute some small misdemeanors, but they may not be able to undertake a prosecution of the whole world of the crime that surrounds that incident. And similarly, police agencies simply don't have the resources to do that, often without our assistance.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the 10% reduction of general fund support for your agency, or how's so much of your funding is federal funds? And is it overall, or how would the split work?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we have a lot of programs that are federally funded, but our strict core district attorney assistance and organized crime operations are primarily funded through general funds.
So the 10% reduction we're talking about is 10% general fund reduction?
Yes. One other thing here to mention on the impact of reductions is that our training and publications, which is geared towards enhancing the ability of prosecutors and police officers to do their job, will be diminished. And let me just give you an example of what, it's hard to anticipate what's the impact of something like that, but an example may help. Every week, the Court of Appeals comes out with case decisions on search and seizure issues. And I believe a year or two ago, one of those issues was that if a police officer searches a car as part of an inventory search, he cannot open a container without separate justification to do that. Well, we conduct training for police officers and district attorneys about those issues. If an officer or a prosecutor went to our training, they're going to know we can't do a case involving that type of search. If they didn't have our training, they may very well conduct that illegal search. The prosecutor may file charges on that case, and that's going to result in a lot of litigation for nothing, which costs the state money. It costs court time, it costs lawyer time, defense attorney time. And that's preventative medicine, essentially, through effective training. And that's what we try to do. Two other comments on what the impacts would be on us. To a lesser extent, our representation of DPSST is funded through DPSST.
If you could hold your thought just for a moment.
Yeah.
You don't want to get too far away from...
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, because I think... I'd ask the committee members to, since the Mr. Briggs has not identified these, but if I'm not mistaken, we want to be sure that we look at the reduction of domestic violence program and also the reduction of the CFs. What is it? Crime, CFAA, what is that?
Criminal fines and assessment.
Which is going to also reduce... child abuse medical programs, regional assessment centers, criminal energy compensation accounts. So as
Mr. Chair, I think that's going to be handled by the next speaker. Because there's sort of two parts to this division.
I'm sorry.
What Mr. Briggs is speaking and what Ms. Gallagher will speak
okay,
in a few minutes.
Okay, good. Good. Thank you.
Please,
I apologize.
Oh, no need to apologize. You're paying attention.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Lastly, I just wanted to touch on, I've mentioned some of the technical services, our Oregon State Intelligence Network, our deconfliction system. We also have our other technical services, including we run the state's wiretap operation, pen registers, and trap and trace devices, which track, with appropriate court orders, they track phone numbers that our suspects are calling. We do video enhancements. All of these things are complex technical operations which require technical expertise, and when you start cutting budgets and cutting corners, that increases the chance that those programs can fail. And so that's one of my concerns. As I briefly mentioned before, the tobacco task force under the governor's recommended budget would be dramatically reduced. The impact of that on us is going to be that we have currently have five major organized crime cases that we're working, and we'd have to stop working four of them. We've had significant success on the internet. We have essentially persuaded all credit card companies to cease facilitating internet transactions for illegal sales of cigarettes. And that's in large part due to the second attorney that we have in this program. Likely result in loss of some revenue. On the next slide, we show a minimum enhancement that we would like to see in order to allow us to continue to work the ongoing caseload and still have some impact on the internet. That would include one assistant attorney general, one financial investigator, and one computer forensic specialist. The next slide reflects ideally what we would have hoped to be able to have in order to maintain a viable, vigorous law enforcement effort in the area of tobacco tax compliance. It's a $500 million revenue stream, and it's to our thinking, important to have some level of law enforcement support in order to maintain compliance with the law. I want to mention this. I'm not sure that the members are familiar. Obviously, cigarettes, taxes are collected through sale of tax stamps. But other tobacco products, primarily chewing tobacco, revenues are collected on the honor system. And the only way you can enforce that is by review of invoices of the person who supposedly paid that. And that's a risky system, and there's a significant opportunity within the honor system for people to violate the law. This policy package obviously recognizes the recommended reduction. Policy package 401.
Representative Hansen?
During the last interim, we struggled with some anticipated revenue that we thought was going to the Department of Revenue for their tobacco compliance effort that didn't materialize. Have you got any type of paper memo that we could see that would talk about the potentials for the amount of general fund that this relatively minimal package would produce? Or if we close it down?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, at the end of phase one, we did provide a paper which was essentially an analysis of the impact of the task force. Hopefully you have those materials, and it includes that type of information. I can, off the top of my head, recall that we had two significant major successes in criminal prosecution involving racketeering convictions, which resulted in judgments of $2.4 million. I think approximately 1.5 of that we should be able to collect because the person had assets. The other person, I think, gambled away the other money. We have five ongoing cases. Because we have financial investigators assigned to the project, they're able to track assets and try to tie those up so that we can recover those as part of the criminal prosecution. So that anecdotal information, I think the more specific information should be included in that report, which we've provided. Policy package 401, the dollar figure here is not exactly correct. What this is the amount of money we're asking through the Federal Department of Homeland Security grant. What we asked for was $139,000. This $202,000 reflects the last grant request that we made, and that includes funding for an analyst position. The Department of Homeland Security has disallowed funding positions, so we cannot fund an analyst position. So we're asking for money for purposes of training folks and also for equipment. Policy package 402. This is another fund billing to the federal HIDA program. We are requesting an analyst 1 position and an electronic tech 2 position. The electronic tech 2 position is currently a National Guard position. National Guard has one person located within our intelligence operation, but they're going to be withdrawing that position. to send that position overseas. And so HIDA has funding approved through the HIDA Executive Board for that electronic tech. Electronic tech is a person who specializes in installing surveillance equipment. And then Policy Package 405 reflects our need for support staff. Currently, we have two full-time legal secretaries and two part-time secretaries to support 61 persons in our operation, and our intelligence operation has no support staff. And so this is asking for one additional support position. And that concludes my presentation.
Thank you very much, Director Briggs. Appreciate your time with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much.
And your preparation. Thank you. Ms. Gallagher, Crime Victims Assistance.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Connie Gallagher, Administrator of Crime Victims Assistance at the Department of Justice. Mr. Neely is handing out a number of different materials for you. One of them I would like to reference right now, which is a follow-up to some of the questions and issues that you raised yesterday. In an effort to stay within our time constraints, I've tried to answer them in writing and hopefully have done so. I'd also like to mention before we start the formal presentation that I have with me today Bonnie Brodigam, who is from the Department of Human Services, and she will be a resource to the committee should there be any questions related to the Department of Human Services. As reflected in our mission statement, we administer two different types of service programs. One is a direct service program, that's the Crime Victims Compensation Program, which provides direct financial reimbursement to victims. In addition to that, we administer three large state grants and one federal grant for victim services. As you've already heard from Mr. Briggs, we are part of the Criminal Justice Division, and you can see in the next slide our portion of the Criminal Justice Division's budget as well as DOJ's budget, and it equals a little over $34 million. The next slide shows the core programs within the Crime Victims Assistance section. They're all authorized by statute, and the earliest one having been authorized in 1977. That would be the Crime Victims Compensation Program. The first budget history slide shows the budget actuals for the 2003 biennium through our projected 2005-2007 governor's recommended budget, and you'll see a proposed reduction of $1.3 million. The next slide also shows the budget history for this section, and you'll notice that it's relatively flat in terms of both FTE and in terms of the revenue. The next slide may look familiar to you. You saw this during phase one, and it shows that the most significant portion of our budget goes out to community providers for the provision of services, approximately 69% of our budget. In addition, 18% of our budget goes directly out to crime victims for reimbursement of their crime-related costs. For the direct service program that we administer, that is the Crime Victims Compensation Program, you may recall that I spoke earlier during phase one about the slow and gradual but very steady growth that we're experiencing in claim applications as well as payments over a period of time. The growth is driven by the factors that you see on the slide. These include changes to eligibility and reimbursement, such as when the Legislative Assembly authorizes additional counseling reimbursement for child witnesses to domestic violence. Also, increases in the crime rate, employment rate, changes in insurance, particularly the Oregon Health Plan, and increases in medical costs are all elements that drive our overall budget. In addition, you'll see that the crime victims assistance budget has increased due to significant program changes. The District Attorney Victim Assistance Program began in 1983, but it was not until 2001 that we had at least a part-time advocate in every county district attorney's office. It was in January of 2002 that the Child Abuse Multidisciplinary Intervention Account was transferred from the Department of Human Services over to the Department of Justice. The Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund is a new program that became operational in January of 2002. That is our only general fund program at the moment. Our Sexual Assault Victims Emergency Medical Response Fund is a new type of medical benefit for sexual assault victims. This fund is dependent solely upon donations and grants, has no new staff, and that became operational on March 1st of 2004. All of the programs on this next slide are currently supported by the criminal fines and assessment account. As several people have mentioned, it is proposed in the governor's budget and that this be shifted over to general fund. While the governor's recommended budget is proposing a 10% reduction over the 2003-05 budget, this should be placed within the historical context, funding context, which shows that victim services have been taking a reduction since the criminal fines and assessment account allocations were changed from the straight percentage allocation that occurred in the 99-01 biennium. I should say all of the programs that are administered by the Department of Justice that have been funded by criminal fines and assessment account.
Members, I would just ask us to remember the principles guiding our budget deliberations around all of the public safety budgets, and hearing that victim services have taken a reduction over a period of time. What was the period of time?
Since 1999-01, that biennium.
Since 99. That's very troubling, given how we are prioritizing our principles and highlighting services to victims. So I would just ask us to keep that in mind as we continue our way through this budget.
This next slide shows the criminal fines and assessment account or general fund reduction by program type. You might remember from the Phase 1 presentation that the criminal injuries compensation account is actually distributed to two different programs. 50% of it is distributed out to the District Attorney Victim Assistance Programs, and 50% is retained for crime victims' compensation payments. The reduction in terms of its impact for the crime victims' compensation program, of course, means that there would be a reduction in the amount of dollars available to reimburse victims. For the victim assistance programs, again, I'd remind you of the presentation in Phase 1, which talked about the difficulty these programs are currently experiencing meeting their statutory obligations. And again, further reduction is likely to find that some programs simply cannot meet the statutory obligations, such as informing victims of their rights and working with them through the criminal justice process. The reduction in the child abuse funds would have multiple impacts. It would probably include a reduction in the availability of specialized healthcare professionals and specialized interviewers, a reduction in the timeliness of assessments, a reduction in the timeliness of criminal investigations, as well as a reduction in officers who have received specialized training in child abuse risk assessment, which are all required by law. At the moment, the only general fund program, as I mentioned earlier, is the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund. The original 2001 appropriation was for $2.5 million. Folks had hoped that we might get $25 million. So this was a drop in the bucket, but people had hopes that maybe this was the start of something positive in terms of general fund dollars going towards a very serious problem in this state. Unfortunately, there's been a reduction each biennium since then as well. The current reduction of approximately $180,000, just to give you an example, could support $20,000 for a crisis line at the Portland Women's Crisis Line, which would include the cost of a language line for non-English speaking callers. This hotline receives approximately 25,000 calls per year from all across the state.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you. Real fast. Is the amounts of money, is that general fund, or where is that? Is that federal grants or?
The Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Fund is all general fund.
Thank you.
There are multiple agencies administering the public domestic violence and sexual assault funds for services, and the Department of Justice works closely with all of the program administrators. Where these programs are located within state service is largely dependent upon two factors. First is the source of the funds. And an example of that would be the Victims of Crime Act. This is a federally funded program that comes down to every state through the U.S. Department of Justice. Because it comes through the U.S. Department of Justice to serve crime victims, there's a natural link with the Oregon Department of Justice, whose mission includes serving crime victims. On the other hand, within the Department of Human Services, you'll find that the Family Violence Prevention and Services Act is authorized from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So again, there's a natural link with the state human services agency. The second key factor in where a program might be located within our state government is the timing of the establishment of the program. Again, if we wanted to look at the marriage license tax, which is presently located within the Department of Human Services, that was established back in 1981. Back in 1981, very few people were providing any services to domestic violence victims, and the logical place at that point in time was the Department of Human Services. The second bullet points out that the state-administered programs may in fact fund similar services, or they may fund very different services. When we look at the amount of unmet need in the state, let's take for example shelter care, we see that it only makes sense for numerous types of funds to go towards support of shelter services for victims of domestic violence. In 2003, there were over 12,000 requests for shelter that could not be met. So yes, programs over at the Department of Human Services and programs at the Department of Justice do fund similar services or the same services, such as shelter beds. On the other hand, there are certain program guidelines and mandates which would allow certain types of services, such as training, education, and prevention, to be met within one funding stream, but perhaps not within a different funding stream. So there are other services that you will find are supported only through one or two of the domestic violence or sexual assault funds within Oregon. Beginning in 2001 with the charge to the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Program to support interagency coordination and collaboration, the program managers of all of the public domestic violence and sexual assault funds have worked very aggressively and collaboratively with each other in order to maximize efficiency and also to make the best use possible of the very scarce public resources. The program managers for all of these funds have met regularly in order to discuss levels of funding, priorities, and gaps. More recently, we have decided that in addition to our program staff working together, that we wanted to hold at least an annual meeting of the advisory bodies for all of the public funders within Oregon. We've held two such meetings with great success. From these meetings has come an action plan. It is the handout that you're looking at right now with the yellow cover. This is geared specifically towards helping the funders coordinate our efforts so that we reduce duplication, improve efficiency, both at the state level as well as and primarily for our local grantees. We want to make sure that the funds are distributed equitably and appropriately to meet the most critical needs. We also want to make sure that the local programs are not overly burdened with administrative requirements that may result from multiple funding sources. We also want to make sure that there are specific project outcome measures and program performance measures in order that the programs, the local programs, retain accountability for the use of their funds. As a result of this process, I'll just mention a couple of the things that have changed. the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice are now using a single application form for two different types of funding. Also, the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services Fund have for 2 years used the same data collection form. Again, this is a more efficient way for the local programs to submit information just one time, and we use that information at the Department of Justice as well as having the Department of Human Services have that information available.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. What are the two programs that share the single application?
It's the domestic violence program at the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Domestic and Sexual Violence Services.
So all of the services provided by both groups have the same form.
Madam Chair and Representative Hansen, there is a small amount of other domestic violence money that's administered by the Department of Justice that does not use that application. There are also other funders of domestic violence services that don't use that application in other state agencies or coalition or other parts of the state. In addition, all of the funders of domestic violence are jointly supporting an equity study. We hope that the Equity Project will, well, we know that the Equity Project will look at the costs of service provision across Oregon as well as the equity of our allocation methods. These recommendations will affect the administration of all the domestic violence and sexual assault public funds. That will probably be completed in 2 years is what we project. There are pros and cons to multiple fund administrators in domestic violence and sexual assault. However, for the victim, I would like to point out that the bottom line is the overall level of funding and the access to services. At this point, I would like to conclude my remarks and give you an opportunity to ask questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gallagher. Questions or comments? Representative Wisnett.
Real fast, Madam Chair. Doug, this $34,000, that's short the $1.5 million from this crime funds acquisition, whatever reduction, and the $250,000 that the governor recommended reduction from the domestic violence programs.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I think you're right. I don't have the documents.
That one.
Yeah. I believe that's right. I'd have to go back
okay,
and check.
Okay, then follow on to that, Madam Chair. So the budget that we looked at for criminal justice of $51 million, is this in addition to that one, to $34 million here?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's a combined.
The 34 is in the 51?
I believe that's right.
Okay.
Representative Hansen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In this sheet, on the first page, there's item four is create white paper on cost key research benchmarks. Would it be possible for me to get a copy of that?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, yes.
Thank you.
Ms. Gallagher, also, thank you very much for the quick turnaround on the responses to the questions we had yesterday about safety planning for victims of domestic violence. This is very helpful information. Thank you.
Madam Chair, you're very welcome.
Anything else for the good of the order, Mr. Wilson?
I do not believe so. Tomorrow there'll be the trial division and the appellate division, public testimony, civil justice unit, trial and appeals, appellate division, as well as public testimony for this agency.
We're planning to put that public testimony in front.
I would think that the best approach, Madam Chair, would be to finish up the divisions mm-hmm. and then do the public testimony after that. And I think then that we give the opportunity for the Attorney General to close after the public testimony, if that's possible.
Okay. We'll plan to do that. Thank you very much, and Mr. Friels, we appreciate that you were sitting in and ready to respond as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We are adjourned.